people in government are willing to listen to young people's voices, and in some cases they're very sensitive to the perspectives of young people. You just kind of have to shout loud enough. Yeah. And sometimes elbow your way into meetings that you have no business being in. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You might think that science is boring, hard to understand, or maybe you believe that scientists are hiding the truth from you about aliens or chemtrails. Well, we're here to prove that wrong. Whether you love science or you think it sucks, this is the show for you. You're listening to episode 15 of Science Sucks. This week, we have Dr. Vanessa Sung, a fresh new doctor who recently defended her PhD in biochemistry at McGill University with a focus on breast cancer. Having wrapped up her PhD, Vanessa now works as a science policy analyst for the Chief Science Advisor of Canada, Dr. Mona Niemer. Now that is a cool job, and I'm so excited to talk to her today. But before we turn it over to her, what even is a Chief Science Advisor? So here is the rundown. According to the official Government of Canada website, the Chief Science Advisor, currently Dr. Mona Niemer, provides impartial scientific advice to the Prime Minister and the Minister for Science. So the Minister for Science is currently Kirsty Duncan, and she's a Member of Parliament who represents her riding or electoral district, and she was chosen to be Minister for Science on the current Prime Minister's cabinet. So a major difference between the Chief Science Advisor and the Minister for Science is that the Minister of Science is a politician and a member of the Liberal Party of Canada. The Chief Science Advisor is not a politician, and the role is meant to be an impartial advisor. As part of her job, Dr. Mona Niemer makes sure that government science is publicly accessible and that scientists can speak freely about their work. Dr. Niemer, as we'll hear from Vanessa, also represents Canadian science to other countries around the world. Now, I did some digging and found out that this is actually a pretty new role. There was a similar position in the government from 2004 to 2008 called the National Science Advisor, but the position was cut under the government of good old Stephen Harper. Now keep that name in mind, because we'll talk more about him later. So after the previous science advisor position was cut, Canada went almost 10 years without one before Kirsty Duncan announced the new position in 2016, which was named the Chief Science Advisor. In 2018, Prime Minister Trudeau announced that Dr. Mona Niemer would fill that role, and that's where we are today. With that bit of background, let's hand over the mic to Dr. Vanessa Sung to talk about her cool job, how to have your voice heard in policy, and the importance of having your very own lady web. Oh yes, you heard that right. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Can you introduce yourself a little bit and tell us about how your journey to science was, where you started and where you are now?
Sure, I can do that. So as you've already mentioned, I'm now a policy analyst with the Chief Science Advisor of Canada, Dr. Mona Niemer. As far as my journey to science goes, I'd say that science has always been a part of my life. My dad was a chemistry professor in Taiwan, so growing up, I spent a lot of time learning and talking about science with him. So I think there was never really any doubt that I was going to end up in science somewhere. I ended up pursuing my PhD in biochemistry with a specific focus on breast cancer research. That has been a really interesting journey. The work is super interesting, and I loved doing bench work. But at some point I realized that, you know, I had interests elsewhere, you know, in fields that are science adjacent, but not necessarily the research itself. And after trying out a few different extracurricular activities, I landed on science policy, and long story short, here I am.
Amazing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you researched for your PhD? What kind of bench work experiments? What was the life like?
So it was really, it was quite basic research. So I worked on the bench. I worked with mice sometimes. I worked with cells in a dish. The focus of my research was on what is called triple negative breast cancer. It's a particularly aggressive subtype of breast cancer. And what I was trying to do was to identify new ways of therapeutically targeting these triple negative breast cancer cells, because right now only 30% of patients with triple negative breast cancer will respond to conventional therapies like chemo and radiation. So there's a real need to find more effective ways of treating these patients. So that's what I worked on. And it was, it was really fulfilling research. I got to do kind of everything from very basic benchtop research all the way up to nearly preclinical. So, testing out the therapies in mice and seeing whether they could be effective in an animal. So actually, I decided to go into cancer research after my dad was diagnosed with brain cancer. So that's kind of what drew me to cancer research. And unfortunately, I think that is quite a common story with cancer researchers.
You do a lot of work with the Chief Science Advisor of Canada, Dr. Mona Niemer, which is really cool and exciting. So tell us about how you landed such a cool opportunity and what kind of work you do in the office.
I first started working with the Chief Science Advisor as an intern last year in the fall, and this was possible because I applied and was accepted into an internship program through McGill, where I did my PhD. So it was it's a pretty new program called the Doctoral Internship Program. So it provides doctoral students who have submitted their thesis but haven't defended yet an opportunity to work up to 3 months as an intern basically anywhere you want.
Wow.
Anywhere that would take you as an intern, essentially. So you're funded for 3 months. Through some connections I made through Science and Policy Exchange, which is the student science policy organization that I used to be co-president of, which I can talk a little bit about later on if you'd like.
Yeah.
Through one of our directors, I was able to land an internship at the Chief Science Advisor's office. And I guess I did a good enough job as an intern that they invited me back to work full time with them. Wow. After I finished my PhD. So here I am.
Amazing. That's an awesome student success story. Internship leads to a job. So what kind of things did you do there?
So my primary role right now at the Chief Science Advisor's office is that I work on anything that's women in science related. Which is really cool for me because it's something that I'm really passionate about anyway, and I had done a lot of work on as a PhD student. So to be able to kind of continue that work into my professional life has been really, really fulfilling. I also work on international files. So anytime that Dr. Niemer is traveling abroad, I do a lot of work to support her in her trips, in her engagement with international stakeholders or her counterparts in governments in other countries. And so it's really great because it gives me a lot of opportunities to learn about other countries and the way that science advice works in other countries and how it compares with Canada's and what we can learn from their systems. Also learning about how they fund their research trying to, learn from their systems and see what best practices they have that we can benefit from.
Wow, That's really cool. Do a lot of countries have science advisors? Is that common across the world?
There are other countries that have chief science advisors for sure. New Zealand, for example, has one. The U.S. also has a science advisor, although their system's a little bit different. And essentially, most countries have, not most countries, a lot of countries have someone who plays this role, but kind of in a different way. Mm-hmm. Some of them will have science advisors, but only specifically in departments and ministries. So I would say Dr. Niemer's role as the kind of a chief science advisor at the federal level is pretty unique. Yeah.
I'm trying to wrap my head around, like, it seems like such a monumental role. Like, what does the chief science advisor do, and what's their kind of duty as a science advisor to the country?
Well, maybe I can tell you about some of the projects and some of the things that go on in the office right now. Yeah. So one of the key pieces of policy that Dr. Niemer's office has worked on recently is the science integrity policy. So this is a policy to ensure that all departments and agencies in the federal government that work on science-related issues have a policy in place that ensures the integrity of the science being done, but also that scientists, federal scientists, have the ability to communicate their results and their science freely, which in the past has been a little bit of an issue. I don't know if you're familiar with some of the challenges that federal scientists have faced previously with regards to sharing their information with the public and internationally. So that's a really important key piece of policy that the office is working on right now.
Remember the name Stephen Harper from the top of the episode? So from 2006 to 2015, Stephen Harper was the Prime Minister of Canada. Yes, folks, that is 9 years. When he was first elected, I was in elementary school, and by the end of his time in office, I was in university. Stephen Harper did a lot of things, and one of those things was keeping scientists from sharing their research with the public. Investigations over the past few years have revealed that Harper government officials blocked media access to scientists. The list of how they did this is long, but it mostly involves scientists researching climate and other quote-unquote politically sensitive issues. Scientists were often barred from talking to media about their research without clear criteria for why that approval was withheld. They were given scripts they had to follow, or government officials would speak on behalf of them. This research was on topics like flooding, snowfall patterns, and Alberta's oil industry. There was deliberate and successful action to silence scientists and create policy that was not based in research. With this history of the previous administration muzzling scientists, it's very much a priority for the current science advisor to make sure that doesn't happen again. So in addition to making sure researchers can speak freely and share their science, what else does the chief science advisor do?
Dr. Niemer is also working on creating a network of department science advisors. So as I mentioned before, you know, a lot of countries have a system where their individual ministries or departments and agencies have their own science advisor. So we're trying to set up a network like that right now. So, for example, you know, the NRC, the National Research Council, has a science advisor. Our space agency has a science advisor, and other departments like Health Canada and Environment Canada are in the process of recruiting their own science advisors. So ultimately, the goal would be to have, as I said, a network of science advisors with different expertise that Mona can kind of convene and work together with them to provide the best advice possible.
Yeah.
So that's a really exciting thing that's going on. Of course, our office also works on science, promoting science and communicating science in the public.
Yeah.
Also something I'm personally very excited about is we're working on creating a youth advisory council. So a council of young researchers, or not necessarily researchers, but people who, youths who are interested in science advice, to come and work with Dr. Niemer to provide perspectives from the next generation of young professionals.
I love youth advisory council. And it seems that young people are often left out of, I guess, in Ottawa, where a lot of political stuff happens. A lot of the politicians are a lot older, because young people aren't starting off their political careers yet, so their voices might go unheard.
Yeah, it is difficult for young people's voices to break through, but it's definitely not impossible. Yeah. If there's one thing I learned over the past few years working in science and policy exchange, is that people in government are willing to listen to young people's voices, and in some cases they're very sensitive to the perspectives of young people. You just kind of have to shout loud enough. Yeah. And sometimes elbow your way into meetings that you have no business being in. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I was recently talking to my cousin. She's 18 and she just started nursing school and had her first mm-hmm. clinical placement. And I was like, did you get to do anything as a first year nurse? Probably not, right? Like, you don't get to do a lot of procedures because you haven't learned them yet. And she's like, I put my nose where I'm not supposed to go. Like, I poke myself into other people's business and people teach me and I learn a lot. And I was like, that's the way to be as a young person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that it is really important for young people's perspectives to be represented at the table, especially when the discussion is about policies that really affect the next generation. And a key example of this is the Naylor report that came out a couple of years ago that really looked at the ecosystem of federal science funding in Canada and identified a lot of gaps that really hurt the next generation of researchers and scientists and young professionals. And so when we're talking about policies that affect the next generation, it's imperative that the next generation's voices are represented. So it's been a real lesson in kind of advocating for yourself and your peers, and finding ways to make people listen, and to find ways to make it clear that you have something valuable to bring to the table.
It sounds like your office is doing a lot to make science more accessible, more inclusive, more well communicated, so that everyone can hear it and share it and understand it.
Yeah, I think maybe you'll allow me to gush about my boss for a few minutes, because
please.
Yeah, she is really quite an incredible person and an incredible woman in science. I think sometimes we can feel a little bit cynical about our political leaders and about the people in power. And Dr. Niemer, she's not a politician. She's doing this job because she believes in the importance of data and evidence in policy making, and she wants to make sure that science and evidence are used in the best way possible. She's really the real deal. You know, every day I've had some very interesting conversations with her, about all different types of issues, especially about women in science, which, as I mentioned, I spend a lot of time working on. So I've had many conversations with her about it, and she clearly spends a lot of time thinking about it very deeply. I consider myself very lucky to be working with her.
It's so important for us to have a cheerleader, a supporter of open science and accessible science in Canada. Mm-hmm. at such a high level. So what would you say is your favorite part of your job?
One of my favorite things about my job are definitely the people in the office. It's a really, really great team. Everybody brings something different. And I think because we're quite a small team trying to achieve a lot in a short period of time, we all have to work collaboratively, and we kind of everybody gets to work on each other's projects and learn a bit from each other. So I mean, I've only been in the office for a short amount of time, but I've had a really great time there, and I felt really welcomed. And one of the things that really struck me was that when I started as an intern in the office, maybe I came in with a preconceived notion of how interns are treated in the workplace. Yeah. Maybe informed by movies, I don't know. But I really felt valued as a colleague, and not as, you know, not as an intern, if you know what I mean. You know, I felt like my opinion was valued, my contributions were valued, and I was just like any other colleague. So that was really striking to me, and you know, really convinced me that this was an office that I could come back to work in and feel really great about it. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned before, you know, because I work on and at the international file, I get to learn something new every few weeks, which is great. And again, being able to work on EDI and women in science as my job, you know, I couldn't ask for anything better.
It's really, really cool that you felt valued in your office. And now you work there, mm-hmm. and you can continue to grow in a different role.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, you've done a lot of work on women in STEM and equity and inclusion outside of your job and outside of your research. So can you tell us a little bit about some of your other projects, maybe including the science and policy exchange that you mentioned earlier?
Sure. And honestly, a lot of my work in EDI and women in STEM have really flowed through my work in science and policy exchange.
EDI, that's equity, diversity, and inclusion, in case you didn't know.
So science and policy exchange, or SPE for short, is a trainee-run nonprofit organization based in Montreal. And we work to do a few things. So we promote science-related issues to the general public. We provide a platform for student perspectives to be represented in the policy sphere. And we provide opportunities for trainees to get involved in policy work and to get exposure to the world of science policy. And we do that, you know, through public forums on issues like genetic editing and genetic information. We did last year, our topics were the opioid crisis and the legalization of cannabis. This year we're doing some on, you know, microplastics and oceans. And we also run workshops. So just recently there was one on science advice. Last year we did one on science diplomacy. And also, as I've mentioned before, we got really involved in advocating for the Naylor Report as well. So there's a little bit of advocacy work there as well. So it's a really multifaceted, kind of fast-moving kind of organization. And I've learned so much from being a part of it. I joined, I think, in 2015 or something like that, and I was co-president of the organization a couple of years ago, and it's really propelled me to where I am today. And I've met really incredible people through the organization, really incredible women in STEM, I really encourage students to to get involved in organizations like SPE.
I feel like as a scientist who's interested in policy, if you don't have those resources and guidance, you might not be able to get there very easily, because I feel like in academia, people want you to stay in academia in like a more traditional path.
I mean, I think that's a huge problem, right? Because we know that most PhDs don't end up in academia, and to go through a system where it feels like if you choose a non-academic career path, you've somehow failed is hugely problematic. And I think if I could give one piece of advice, it's that it's okay to start thinking about non-academic career paths right from the beginning of your PhD, if you choose to pursue a PhD. One thing that that someone told me once that really changed my perspective on PhDs and career paths is that, you know, while you're pursuing a PhD, it feels like that's normal. You know, in academia, everyone and their mother has a PhD, so it doesn't really feel that special. But as soon as you step outside of academia, people recognize there's value that you've completed a PhD. It's a real accomplishment. And there are skills and competencies associated with having a PhD. And, you know, so PhDs are really valuable in all sectors in society.
Yeah.
And, you know, you haven't failed. It's not a waste of time to do a PhD in science, even if you don't end up in academia, because God forbid we have a society filled with people who are, you know, have really strong science backgrounds and understand how science and evidence works, right?
So
I think it's not only is it okay, but it's imperative that trainees think about their career opportunities and different types of career paths and understand that all of those career paths are legitimate. And I guess I'll take the opportunity to also shout out that there is a science policy student group at Toronto as well, at U of Toronto. They're called Toronto Science Policy Network. It was co-founded actually by my sister. So I kind of guess my influence rubbed off a little bit on her there. But they're doing really, really great work. They've already put on a lot of really successful events. So if you're in Toronto and you want to find out what science policy is all about, definitely check them out.
Yes. Oh, I didn't know it was founded by your sister.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I went to one of their events where they had a science communicator talk about how to use social media for science. So like Instagram, okay. Twitter. So they run really great events all across Toronto. Do you have any advice for young women in STEM?
I feel funny about giving advice because I feel like I'm still, you know, I'm constantly learning it's weird to feel like you're in a place in your life where people might ask you for advice, but I guess I can share some of the things I've learned along the way. So one of the things that I've learned that actually I wish I had figured out earlier on in my career is that you should try and find different mentors to fulfill different needs. So for a long time, you know, I had one mentor who I was going to who I thought that should be able to give me advice on, you know, most of the things in my life. And I've come to realize that's not sufficient, and it's okay to have many different mentors. And so that's something that's really helped me in terms of getting the advice that I need and getting the support that I need to advance my career. And I guess one other thing I would say is, as a woman in science, or just as a woman, surround yourself with women that you want to see succeed and who you want to see succeed. Do you listen to the podcast Call Your Girlfriend?
I do.
Okay. Yeah. I really love that podcast. I love Anna and Amina. And this was a little while ago. I can't remember which episode it was, but they were talking about building a lady web. Do you remember this?
I only recently started listening to it, so I might have missed that episode, like, before I...
Yeah. So this is what I'm talking about, the network of women who you want to see succeed and who want you to succeed. And they called it a lady web, and I've really tried to integrate this concept into my life and surround myself with women who support me and who I want to support, and check in with each other frequently and help each other as much as possible, because, you know, it's so important to have this support system around you. And and some of the best advice that I've ever received have come from my lady web, and I think it's so important.
But I feel that so strongly. I feel like this year I've been really seeking out support systems and mentors in different fields and different kind of areas of life, like a personal, someone you can call when you're stressed, or someone that can give you career advice, someone that can you know, help you, or, you know, go for a walk with you when you need to clear your head. So all these different needs can be met with, like, a group of supportive people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's such, I love that podcast so much.
Yeah.
And where can people find you? Your social media, any upcoming projects or events?
So I'm pretty active on my Twitter, which you can find me at @Sung_Vanessa. I also have a website that I share with my sister, my sister Molly Sung. The website is sungsisters.ca. We're not terribly active on it, but we do post links there to any work that we've published, or writing that we've done, interviews, that sort of thing. So you can also find me there.
Thank you so much for joining me for the podcast. I learned a lot from you, and I hope that everyone listening knows a little bit more about the state of science and science policy in Canada and the work you do.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to our interview. My favorite part of that chat was Vanessa saying you have to elbow your way into meetings you have no business being in. And I feel that. So young folks, while it is the responsibility of politicians to serve your needs, they don't always do a good job. So take Vanessa's advice and shout loudly until politicians start to listen. So that's it for our chat today. You can follow Vanessa on Twitter at @Sung_Vanessa and her website at sungsisters.ca. That's SUNG. If you are policy curious at McGill University, check out the Science and Policy Exchange. And if you're in Toronto, check out the Toronto Science Policy Network. I've linked it all below. The podcast we mentioned is Call Your Girlfriend, and you should definitely check them out. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @ScienceSucksPod and let us know what you think of the show. Give us a rate and review on iTunes so other people can find the show. And thank you for tuning in. So go out there, elbow your way into opportunities, build your lady web, and have a beautiful week.